This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 64th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me my good friend Marcus Schumacher. Hi, Marcus.
Hi, Gary. Pleased to be in the show today.
Marcus Schumacher is co-founder and CEO of Virtual Forge, a startup based in Heidelberg, Germany. Prior to founding Virtual Forge, Marcus worked at SAP in product security. Dr. Schumacher's thesis work was on security engineering with patterns at Darmstadt University of Technology, parts of which were adapted into the book Security Patterns, published in 2005. Marcus has a long history as a developer, a consultant, and an entrepreneur. He lives in Germany with his wife, Annette, and he also plays a mean guitar. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for making it happen.
You've worked in huge corporations like SAP and startups like Virtual Forge in your widely varied career. What are the major differences in the range between a gigantic corporation and a startup?
The metric of getting things done is much better in smaller companies. You want to do something, and in small companies, you usually get it done, although the big problem is that there are all of a sudden too many things that should be done.
Mm-hmm. So sometimes we talk about wearing hats. You say, well, in a startup, you have to wear all of the hats. So you have to be
exactly,
the QA guy and the tech support guy and the developer and the CEO and the business development person all at the same time. Are there any benefits of working for a huge corporation? Like, what was the funnest part of working for SAP?
Well, the nice thing is that you usually work in a very interesting market. So in particular at SAP, I highly appreciated that we have a software that we usually don't see as an end user, but that effectively controls the complete economy of the world. So when SAP fails, we are in real trouble. We don't need to talk about stock prices or financial crisis in the US or so.
Yeah.
It's the middleware, the ERP system that matters. And that's what I found most interesting.
Mm-hmm. No Coke for you if SAP goes down.
I think even if it would go down, the SAP systems are still needed.
Sure. So Virtual Forge is producing and selling a code scanning tool for SAP's ABAP code. That's kind of a scripting language built into the SAP ERP engine. So why did it take a startup like Virtual Forge to build this sort of thing? Why didn't SAP build their own code scanning technology?
Well, they have a basic code scanning technology, but I always thought that it's not sufficient. So, as you know, I know your work from the very early days and was a big fan all the time, and I really like to have that in place for SAP technology too, but and that's the disadvantage in large companies. You want things, but you don't get them done because there are so many people who say, this is not my job.
Right. So getting the bureaucracy to build the code scanner was a difficulty, or was it feeding the beast or building a new version? What was the hardest part?
I would say it's just a matter of priorities. And in a software company that focuses on business applications, the focus is usually on the application and not so much at the technology end of things.
Mm-hmm. So probably a lot more attention paid to making sure that there are security features available for the end users and functions and stuff like that.
That's the one thing. And the second thing is that we didn't have the tool in the first place, and it wasn't the our first idea when we left SAP. So the first idea was that we do security consulting, code reviews, penetration testing, and so on. And we found out that it's pretty smart to automate that process.
So in terms of automation, can you contrast your ABAP tool with the kinds of tools that are now produced by HP and IBM, you know, the Fortify and Out stuff?
Well, you mentioned the market leaders. That's what I consider them for code scanning of literally any language that you can imagine. So I see that they have a generic approach for scanning different types of programming languages, whereas we focus on a single language, which is very complex and very specific. So I would say if you like to get some results scratching on the surface, you can use other tools. If you like to dig deeper, you should use ours, because we are the experts in that domain.
So it's a matter of the knowledge that's built into the tool.
Exactly, and delivering meaningful results in the end.
Right, right. I don't know much about ABAP as opposed to, say, Java or C++ or maybe even Perl. What is it most like?
Like everything. So it's more than 30 years old, and the people try to adopt literally every programming paradigm that you could see in the last three decades.
Wow.
So it's really tough to understand what's happening, in particular if you have legacy code which has been developed over the years.
So they've always supported their previous versions and new releases.
Yes, and features are never abandoned. So you have them for 30 years.
So maybe it's more like Common Lisp than anything else. That is, there's a kitchen sink built in that somebody wrote one time.
Yes, yes, that's a good analogy.
So a lot of people talk about this issue of false positives still in code scanning, and you and I have had this discussion the other way around before. But I'm wondering, how much of an issue is this false positives problem among your customers, and what do you do when it crops up?
In our previous discussion, you came up with the term of the ugly baby, that the developer says, hey, this is the most beautiful child on earth because I raised it. And we come in and say, this is the ugliest baby that we have ever seen, and we show issues in it. And that's why we see that people deny because of pride or lack of knowledge or whatever, that things could be an issue.
Even if they are.
Even if they are.
So that's really a true positives problem.
even worse, yes. So that's one discussion, and if it comes to false positives, by nature of a static code analysis, there are false positives. And however, we try to prioritize the findings by calculating the probability of an exploitation with data flow and control flow technologies. So we can say this SQL statement has a direct data path to an input field in a form which can be reached by an HTTP handler. So we say there's a high probability on that one.
Right, because it can obviously be exploited.
Exactly, and if they're in the data path, if there's any sanity check or an authority check or whatever, we reduce the probability. So we say there's a complete list of findings, and those with a high probability should be fixed without long discussions.
Right, right. So part of your idea is to help people figure out what to do first.
Yes.
I guess one of the problems in our field now is that, from my perspective and among my customers, the narrative in software security appears to be mostly about finding bugs rather than fixing bugs. And so there's an awful lot of talk about what's better, static analysis or dynamic analysis or some combination. And people are arguing over which one finds more bugs. And the problem is we're already finding so many bugs, we're not sure which ones to fix already. Do you see that problem too? And do you see it changing anytime soon?
We see that problem because many of our clients start to conduct a security or quality test on a large scale for the first time. So we look at code that has been written for over 10 years or longer, and they have a large amount of possible findings and don't know what to do. So fixing things is really a big issue, and our answer to that is that we also provide guidance. For example, what can you, where is the quick fix? So if I have 100 findings with a very high risk and I can fix each of them in 5 minutes, it might be a smart idea to do that first. And our technology provides such guidance too. So
are you finding that customers are actually doing the fixing? Because in the early days, we found people that were doing tons of static analysis, but really just piling the bugs up into some gigantic bug cesspool and ignoring them.
We see that people, so the more mature customers work on getting secure and cleaning up the mess, and then they go to the next level and try to stay secure, which we support with our technology too.
I see. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. Let's switch gears a little bit. Do you think that security people understand the notion of security patterns?
Yes and no. So sometimes they realize that it's smart to not reinvent the wheel every time. However, all of them are, to a certain extent, engineers and like to write their own stuff. So that's why we see supposedly new security solutions every once in a while.
Because you have a not-invented here problem.
Yeah. And yeah, if you go look back for the last 10 or 15 years, you had distributed systems all time. In the early days, they called it CORBA, or we had Genie and applets, and today it's called web services or the cloud. But I think there's no big difference in the key problems that we have. So solutions should be similar, but
I guess
they are not.
I guess I was looking for a slightly different angle here. It strikes me that a lot of people that work in software security are pretty good at breaking stuff, but they're not really developers in many cases. And so when you show them a pattern and you talk to them about hardcore security engineering, from a development perspective, that's a little confusing sometimes. How about developers? Do you think that generally speaking, developers understand the idea of security patterns and are using them?
I would say that they understand it because it's very convenient if you have to do something which is not your day-to-day work. It's really helpful to use a working blueprint. On the other hand, and that's the more interesting thing, I learned that it's not easy to understand what the problem actually is.
Right.
So the hardest thing to write down a proven solution is to understand the real problem in the first place.
Like where it should be applied.
Yes.
I see. Can you give us an example or two of a security pattern of the sort that you had in your book?
Yeah, a very simple one is a checkpoint or choke point where you decide where you make security decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know that when you travel to Germany visiting me, you have to cross the border and there's a check. So that's the place for looking up your ID and do more things if you look strange.
And somehow they've let me in every time.
Yeah, that's surprising. That's a very, very real-life example that should be applied in software, too, that you have defined choke points where you enforce your security policies. Very typical one.
I think that's a good one to talk about because it emphasizes the fact that security patterns have a lot to do with design and maybe less to do with implementing some sort of feature like cryptography.
That is correct. So, however, you can have security patterns at different levels of abstraction. You mm-hmm. can have them at the design level or higher at the architecture level or lower at the code level. That's right. Possible too.
Right. Yep. Well, we've found an awful lot of companies that are doing software security in a large scale at the enterprise level are using middleware. And we asked them about where that comes from and what kind of patterns they use when they develop it in the BSIM study. We found a lot of people that are using that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing to see that in software development, things are getting better in the past 10 or 20 years.
I think so, too. It's good to hear that you believe that. So before you got into security, I think you were working on technology transfer, right?
Yeah, I was at the university in a small team, and that was the time where I started to like small teams.
and you went to SAP anyway?
Yes, just to understand how big teams work and whether I like it or not. So right. in that small team, we were completely responsible for making our own money and working with international companies. And I found that most interesting to have research and development projects at an international level and transferring what happens at the university to the industry and vice versa. That was very challenging.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, long ago we had a science lab at Cigital and we're working on things like static analysis. And tech transfer is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. I think that there are a lot of things that make it a challenge, but what do you think makes tech transfer so challenging? Is it a time problem, a person problem, a money problem? What do you think?
I think it's a problem of perception. When a scientist says, we solved it and everything is understood and working, the people in the industry just start with such new ideas and try to understand it. Why do they need this? So the first question that I asked my people was, why are we working on this particular new technology? How do we improve processes or problems that possible users have? So the use case of it, it's one of the key things. And then transferring a new idea to being industry ready is a long way sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes a long time. I've found that really having a person kind of spearhead the effort, even though it takes a decade, is sometimes the answer to that. Did you find that in your work too? Or
yeah, it's the 2-10 idea. People think it takes 2 years, and in reality, it takes 10 years to get it up and running.
Right.
Especially and adopted by the market.
That's right. Well, especially if you're talking about wide-scale global adoption. That's what it mm-hmm. took for the static analysis stuff. I mean, it's just finally being taken wide by HP and IBM, I suppose. And it's been 10 years. So let's switch gears entirely. So when it comes to mixology, which I know is something you and I have been working on together, what is your favorite beverage that's made in Heidelberg?
The one that you individually mixed the last time. I think it was a liberal.
Oh, a liberal. Did you figure out how to make those over there?
No, I only drink them when you are in town.
What's the name of that one bar?
The one bar that you like most is in the Print Media Academy.
Oh, right, Print Media. That's right. And then last and really most important of all, as a public service announcement, when is your band Out of Damage going to play the next gig and where will it be?
We play by the end of August in a town called Saarbrücken.
Good. Can you send us a URL? We'll make sure to put it on the website.
I will.
Great. Well, thanks, Marcus. It's been interesting. Appreciate your time.
And thank you for calling me today.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The July-August issue of IEEE S&P features an article on trustworthy computing as well as an interview with John Savage. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.